What's up, guys? Welcome to the Flawed Dad's Guide to Parenting, the podcast all about the average flawed dad learning to be a better parent. Today, we're going to take a little different approach. Graham is going to be interviewing me, Warren, and asking me all the questions that you guys have sent in and have been looking for answers on. Strap in, because we're going to talk about all kinds of things, philosophical, my life, all sorts of different topics. Stick around and listen as a couple flawed dads figure out how not to screw up our kids too bad.
Warren, you're in the hot seat tonight.
I am.
Ready. Yeah, getting ready for the interviews. The tit for tat, as I said earlier tonight. Just a fun opportunity to actually say that word. You don't get to do that very often, that statement.
No, it's not one that's used that much anymore.
Don't understand where it came from. Sounds dirty, but I used it. It makes sense.
I've never looked into that, but now I will.
Spiking that curiosity.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, I'm looking forward to this. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. We'll see. We'll dive deep into the world of Warren.
Into the mind of Warren. It's a pretty scary place, but you're welcome inside.
I think we'll touch largely, given that this is more of a parenting world. Mm-hmm. I'll try and touch a little bit more on that, but as we did with my interview, it's always important to go through and figure out the Warren from the beginning ages early on and sure, up to parenthood. Mm-hmm. As to maybe explaining where things have come from, etc.
So, makes sense to me.
Why don't you explain a little bit about your upbringing, your childhood, what it was like, go from there.
Sure. I grew up here in the Vancouver area. I have a younger sister who's just 14 months younger than I am. Two working parents. You know, my dad worked in finance. My mom worked in sales for a printing company. Two very, very hardworking individuals. So very driven, but also very busy, which meant that when I was young, we had nannies, particularly nannies from Germany, and wonderful, wonderful people. I was very fortunate to have them in my life. A few of them are still in my life that we keep in contact with. But, you know, there was a lot that I learned from my parents in terms of drive and motivation and, you know, work ethic, those sorts of things, that from a very early age. My sister and I went to public school in West Van until I was eventually shipped off to boarding school because I was kind of a shit. And so spent 5 years, my senior school years in boarding school. Yeah, you know, regular family life, all that sort of thing.
Yeah. So the reasons for getting sent off to the boarding school side of things, we won't go into all the details, of course, but, you know, from your, I guess, looking from your now parent eyes, mm-hmm, and looking back at things, can you figure out or learn what exactly was there maybe reasons why that started to happen and what went there?
Yeah, I think so. Best thing my parents ever could have done for me. You know, the public school stream did not have that extrinsic motivation that I needed, right? Mm. You were very much left to yourself to figure things out for yourself. And I was easily swayed by other kids. You know, peer pressure for me was highly effective. And so it was the wrong kind of peer pressure that was taking place. And mm-hmm, so as my mom tells me, she could see me very quickly going off the rails in terms of the kids that I was hanging out with and that sort of thing. So, you know, they made a significant sacrifice in paying for me to go to a boarding school that was very expensive at the time. But they knew that it was in my best interest. I wasn't happy about it at the time, but for much of my time at that school, I strongly disliked it because of the constraints that it put on me and how overbearing it was in terms of monitoring everything that you do and how much it pushed you to focus on your university career, that sort of thing. But it challenged me, and the teachers there were very inspiring. They stepped up and really made sure that you had reason to succeed.
Right.
And it wasn't a school where there was, you know, participation trophies.
Right.
It was very much, you know, a school that was meritocracy based. Yeah. And that worked really well for me.
Right.
You know, I met one of my best friends there, and he and I constantly competed.
Right.
For everything. Every mark, every, you know, every sport, everything. And so we drove each other. And so it gave me that extrinsic motivation that I needed to push myself towards university and that sort of stuff. So from a parenting decision, it was the best thing my folks ever could have done for me.
Now, that boarding school wasn't without mischief, though.
Oh, no, definitely not. No,
it solved everything from what I know about you.
Definitely not. No, I got into lots of trouble. I had, bottles of alcohol taken from my room in the boarding house and sent back to my parents. And, you know, there was lots of trouble still.
Right.
But I can only imagine how much more trouble that would have been had I not had the oversight of a staff of, 40, you know, looking after to ensure that I wasn't going too far off track. And in reality, I would say that they were fairly, looking back now, you know, then I saw them as incredibly overbearing. Now I see them as pretty lenient given the path, you know, that I could have taken myself on.
And when this information gets back to your parents, what happens there? What do they do? What did they do?
Alcohol
my folks, gets sent back.
Yeah.
Is it like boys will be boys for you? Like what happens there?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
Pretty much. I mean, my folks, as much as they were, you know, fairly strict, they were also fairly understanding that, you know, as you said, boys will be boys, and none of it was so bad that I was going to really damage my future.
Right.
And most of these things that I was getting in trouble for at school, I would then, over the summer or over weekends at home, get in trouble for doing the same thing there. So it's not like my parents could point the finger at the school and go, "You're not doing a good enough job of parenting our child."
Right.
Because, you know, it was just who I was. Yeah. I was constantly pushing boundaries and wanting to find the limits of everything.
Well, the only reason why I bring up the question is more just about the approach from your parents' side. I'm trying to sort of loop that back in a little bit about, you know, the upbringing side of things, of their disciplinary side of things. So it sounds like you said they're strict, but sometimes they're also a little bit more forgiving. So
It's largely because my dad recognized his life experience in what I was going through, right?
Okay.
That my dad experienced a very similar upbringing.
Boarding school as well?
He did go to, he actually went to the same school that I did.
Okay.
But only for 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
Because he got beaten with the strap so badly that when he came home, he was completely covered in bruises. His mom and his sister would not allow him to go back. So he was only there for grade 10 and then returned to public school. And so, you know, I think he saw a lot of himself in me. At the same time, my parents had their hands full with my sister. And Lindsay, if you hear this, no judgment. But I mean, you know what you were like as a teenager. So they had their hands full in dealing with things at home. And so the things that I did seemed inconsequential in comparison to some of the stuff that they were dealing with my sister.
Right.
And Lindsay's turned out amazing, but there were some big challenges during that time where they were much more concerned about what could happen to her than they were concerned about what could happen to me, because they had the support system from the school to look after me, where they didn't have that with my sister.
Mm.
And so I think that probably shows up a lot in the way that I'm parenting my kids.
Yes.
In that, you know, as you know, my oldest daughter is going to a school for children with learning disabilities and that sort of thing. So we've put a large emphasis and a large sacrifice on ensuring that she's got the education to support her, right? Whereas where the other two girls are still going to school in the community here, I'm doing an hour and a half commute each way with her.
Yes.
For a private school in order to make sure that she's getting the right education. And so we're kind of leaning on the available resources, much like my parents did with me,
yep,
in order to assist so that we can focus on some of the other issues that are happening in the household.
And that's certainly a topic that we won't go into right now, but one debate that I think that we will have is about private school versus mm-hmm. public school mm-hmm. and our different opinions on that.
It's a big one.
It is. You and I both have opinions, sort of research through experiences, et cetera, which is always
anecdotal, but yeah,
that's the very tough part about parenting, et cetera, is that most of it is sort of an anecdotal. Well, mm-hmm. this, I think, you know, worked well for me. Ipso, it should probably do okay with this situation and, you know,
but
so many experiences.
As we discussed in what was it, our third episode with Yuko Munakata, right? That all parenting advice is wrong,
right?
Because it's applied unilaterally across all children, and so
versus nurture.
Yeah,
well,
yeah, that's right. What worked for me?
Does it matter about private school?
That's right.
Anyways, we're getting into the conversation we shouldn't.
Yeah, I think it worked for my particular personality.
Yeah,
and that's, you know, and we've made that decision for one of our daughters because we're seeing a remarkable impact because of it.
Right.
So, you know, maybe she's more like me, which, God, I feel bad for her, but, you know, it's working.
Yeah.
So
you got through high school mostly unscathed, things like that.
Yeah.
And got into university, which, you know, the school was
I never would have. I don't think I ever would have made it into university if I had not gone to the school that I did.
Yeah.
I think it had, you know, there was a couple teachers in particular, a Dr. Matthews and a Dr. Mercer. You know, we had, you know, teachers with their PhD. There were doctorates in their different areas that were instructing us.
Right.
You know, they could be professors and they're teaching high school, right? And it wasn't just their academic prowess, but their ability to get us involved and interested.
Yes.
And so I had some incredibly inspiring people that taught me, and I've tried every day since then to take that inspiration and hope that I can pass it on to my kids, right? In finding topics or subjects or, you know, even personal growth that they can grab onto that those same teachers were able to give me.
Yeah. So then you move on to university and your rebellious phase is all gone.
No,
right?
Not at all. No.
No?
No.
That's surprising.
Yeah, well, I mean, you were there too, so.
I'm loading the question. Yeah. I know the answer.
No, it didn't. I think I spent my first 2 years at university basically floundering, just trying to figure out who I was and where I stood. And, you know, nearly failed myself out of school because I was so focused on the social life and the other aspects of university rather than academic learning and personal growth. So
now that's interesting. Do you think that has anything to do with your experience before university?
It's very possible because I was leaving an environment that was so tightly controlled and really had a lot of that extrinsic motivation to go to an area where you have none of that, where it all has to come from internal, that sort of thing, that it certainly could have played a role in it. I mean, it got me to university and it gave me the skills to be able to get through university. But it didn't, that significant change probably played a role in, you know, this burgeoning sense of, oh my goodness, I'm free.
Yes.
And then, you know, you just go overboard in terms of everything, excess on everything.
Yeah. And that's partly why I'm asking, you know, the things I always think of are like a listing ship. right? You list too far, and then the counterbalance is like you list so far the other way, and then you back and forth and back and forth. Whereas, you know, or fad diets.
Yeah.
Not that I've necessarily participated in them, but just seeing other people going through them, et cetera. It's just so, you're so regimented. You're so, and then the second you're finished, you're like, oh yes, I can't wait to have whatever it is. And then you just blow the roof off because it's over, right? You stressed yourself so much. So that's
interesting. Yeah, I think it likely did. It likely did play a role. But I think that it also gave me the ability to get myself back on track.
Yes.
When I realized that I was going off track.
Yeah.
Right? Because there was still inspiration and motivation to become successful.
Right.
And not to just waste my time, to make something of my time at university.
So what changed for you? The first 2 years, you know, almost getting flunky out, as you said, challenging, et cetera. Year three, what modified it for you?
Well, actually, I took year three off.
Okay.
I went with one of our fraternity brothers, Keith, and we traveled through Europe for 3.5 months backpacking. I was working as a fishing guide up in Haida Gwaii through the summers, and came back, did my travels, incredible experience, you know, traveling with a guy who was very intelligent, very driven. We had incredibly different perspectives on the world, right? He was hardcore socialist, and I was very, very much on the path of capitalism. And that experience and the conversations we had really brought me back to earth in terms of wanting to focus on doing something productive with my time at university. Now, it came back, you know, end of December. I needed to wait 8-9 months until school was starting back up again. And so I wound up having a job as a supervisor in a door factory.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very, very quick learning experience for me to understand that I did not want to be doing labor for the rest of my life.
Right.
That really inspired me to go back and take my schooling seriously.
Right.
And so went back, renewed focus on what I wanted to do at school, that sort of thing, and it really was foundational in giving me that motivation. Yep. Now I had intrinsic motivation to be successful at university.
Yeah. So if you could go back in time,
mm-hmm.
you know, little Warren, you're just getting out of high school, do you tell him anything different? Do you steer him to do anything different than what little Warren did before?
I think I probably would. If I'm going back from like 2020 hindsight right now,
yep.
and looking back to then, I would probably dissuade myself from putting so much emphasis on traditional careers that are what you learn about in school.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
That, you know, these are the options you have. You can be a lawyer, you can be a doctor, you can be a businessman, you can be an accountant. It's so incredibly defined and narrow in scope. Whereas the world of career opportunities is so broad now.
Yes.
That anything you are passionate about can be a profession.
Yes.
And I would give myself that message and tell myself to take significantly greater risks early on,
mm-hmm.
to explore all the avenues where there's potential passion.
Right.
And that is a key message that I will teach my kids.
Yeah.
Is that no matter what it is that drives, that you're passionate about and inspires you, motivates you, take that and we can figure out a way for you to turn it into a profession.
Yeah.
Because people will pay you for anything at this point, right? There are people
selling bathwater.
Yes.
Them being in their own baths and selling that. I mean, that is...
Yeah. You could... anything. anything you possibly want to do, you can make a living off of it.
Just find the market.
Yeah, that's right. And find how to market it to them.
Yeah.
That's all it is. And so if I can help my kids to find a way to turn their passion into a profession without taking the passion out of it.
That's a big one.
That's the big challenge, right? You know, making sure that, and a part of that is just being willing to pay other people to do the jobs that you don't want to do within that little passion, right? To be able to offload and purely focus on the stuff that you're really good at and that you're passionate about, that sort of thing. So, that's what I would go back and tell myself is explore every opportunity and take the risks to follow every one of those rabbit holes.
Right.
Because you have no idea which one of them turns into a $1 billion idea.
Yep.
Right. And not only does it turn into something that you're incredibly, you know, rewarded for, but it's one that you can be really passionate about. Not that I'm not passionate about what I do now, but I could definitely see areas of my life where that passion can shine through even more.
Yeah. And that's similar to what I sort of went through mm-hmm. as well, and sort of realizing is that, yeah, it's tough. The world was different. It feels forever ago that it seemed like you were sort of destined to choose this, go into university or not. There was no, it was a stigma, I think, as well, really, you know, at least maybe within my peer group and your peer group, et cetera, it's just what you did.
Yeah.
Was you go on to university.
Right. Oh yeah. Yeah. We had a 98% university enrollment rate for our school.
Yes.
Right. Where, you know, a traditional public high school in our area is something like 48%.
Yeah.
Right. So it was everybody other than what, like 6 people in our grad class were going to university.
It's even one of those things to this day I haven't looked into. But getting into university, if you take a year off, I feel like, well, you have to apply because you're coming out of high school
mm-hmm.
and that's the only chance that you have to get into the university. So mm-hmm. you have to do it. I don't know whether that's the case still.
Or I don't what know the deal either.
Is, but I still have that
yeah.
mental thought is, well, you have to because
yeah.
this is otherwise you're gonna have to do other things to be able to get into the university.
I have heard, and I was listening to a podcast the other day where they were talking about university enrollment and stuff, and they were saying that a lot of the universities are focusing more on diversifying their applicants and the pool of students because they need to draw from different walks of life in order to bring in different education experiences and shared knowledge, yeah. those sorts of things. So, and a big part of that is changing the age of students coming in,
yes.
right? Bringing in more experienced individuals so that they can share that experience with brand new, you know, recent high school graduates.
Yeah.
And I think that's incredibly valuable. I think that's yes, something that should be happening. So, you know, I'm not sure I would push my girls to go straight to university out of high school. I think that university is still valuable in terms of its ability to give you the skills to study and find knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I think when you and I were going through it, the internet and everything was around, but it wasn't as pervasive in our lives as it is today. The way that we found knowledge at that point was largely still through libraries and
right.
internet sources were discredited by yes. by our professors, by our teachers, that sort of thing. Now, entire libraries are online.
Yes.
Right? Many, you know, books, everything is online. And so by the time our kids get to university, the way that they learn, the way that they seek knowledge is going to be completely different from the way that we did.
And that part is going to be wild too, thinking
yeah,
10 years out.
I think the more important skill for our kids to learn is how to disseminate accurate information from inaccurate information. to be able to weed yes. through all of the, you know, fake news as it may be, or to be able to look at sources and resources and understand, is this actually a valuable source?
Yeah.
Because anybody can write a book and self-publish today.
And that's the challenge, is I feel I'm becoming way more of a cynic about everything now, especially delve more into the online world. Like, I don't believe that, you know, I need to go and find 10 other things. And even if you understand how the world works a little bit about the way that
backlinks and
websites work, and you think, I don't know if I believe any of these people really. This all is just to, like, it's a wild world and time that we live in here.
Yeah.
The only true currency I feel is that when a YouTube channel or a podcast, things are where people have spent a committed amount of time on a particular topic and continually write about it and developed somewhat of a rapport.
They're an authority.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think those are the only real ones, the areas that you can at least place a little bit more of a bet on things.
It becomes a bit of proof in the pudding sort of thing, where it's, you want to see them actually do the task over and over and over again before you. But also recognizing that anything that's going up on YouTube or in a podcast or anything can be heavily edited.
Yep.
And so you're only seeing the part that they want you to see. It's such a controlled persona at this point. So what I was getting to was I don't know if I would push my girls to go straight into university. I think there's value in them getting life experience. I'll be much more influential on having them follow whatever it is their passion is, whether it's music or video games or anything. You know, I just want to ensure that they are taking the opportunities that present themselves, particularly in a time where following those opportunities has very, very low marginal cost to them.
Yes, right.
Right? The marginal utility of time at that point is basically zero. You know, there is no rush for them to get through it, you know, in order to get on to a profession, because they're not missing anything.
Yeah.
And who knows what it is that they're passionate about that creates their career for them.
Yeah.
So... yeah, that's kind of my stance on it. I think that's what I would go back and tell myself.
Yeah.
And it's exactly what I will tell the girls.
Yeah. So you got into the career world, et cetera. We can go into that if you'd like. But I'm more interested. Have you always wanted to be a father?
No. I think I did when I was younger. I wanted to be a dad, but when I was going through university, I did not want to bring kids into the world. So I was a human geography major, right? So it's a multidisciplinary, you know, sociology, political science, physical geography, you know,
destined for career success.
Like you're either becoming a city planner or a professor, right? Like those are the two kind of directions that that come out of what I was doing. My original intention was to go into real estate development. I realized that I didn't have any capital though, which you kind of need to do real estate development. Very minor. Anyways, so the education path that I was on was very left-leaning and very what's the right word for it? It apocalyptic, right? It really showcased how bad of a path the planet was on,
right?
From a physical geography perspective, in terms of erosion and melting of polar ice caps and climate change, all these different things, to from political science side, understanding the massive changes that we're going into from a terrorism perspective, these sorts of things, to sociology and the movement of people and mass migration. And it was just, it was really, it gave you a very ugly picture of the planet.
Right.
that things were never going to get better, and that the more population we added to the planet, the more damage we were going to do.
Okay.
And so I did not want kids. I thought that it was not fair for me to bring kids into the world.
Yes.
To an extent, I still kind of feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
I feel bad for the girls in what it is that they have to watch happening now in terms of terrorism and poverty and socioeconomic divides. And, you know, you look at what's happening right now with the political spectrum just going so far to the opposites, and the hatred that takes place between two political parties that are unable to come to any semblance of compromise, even when it's in the best interest of their constituents.
Yeah.
Like, that is a really scary world
yep.
to grow up in. And so I feel really bad that I brought the girls into a world that's all they're ever going to know. Right?
Yes.
That's their basis for understanding humanity.
Right.
And so it wasn't actually until I had graduated, and I graduated, I'd been out in the world for a little bit, and I was like, I kind of want kids. At the time, my grandmother had passed. She played an incredibly huge role in my life. And I knew that if I was going to have kids, if at this point, I wanted to have them young so that they got the opportunity to meet my parents.
Okay.
Right? Because I lost my mom's dad before I was born, my dad's parents when I was 3, and then my mom's mom was the only one, my maternal grandmother was the only one that I grew up with.
Right.
And she was this powerful, like small statured Scottish woman, you know, just a very, she was a powerhouse, like a true matriarch.
Yeah.
She ran her household. Now, she ran it through guilt, but she really was the centerpiece of this entire household. Of the Stuart clan. And I really wanted, if I was going to have kids, for my kids to know my parents and the impact that they had had on me.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing that, you know, in meeting women in my life, I knew that that was the direction I was going to go. So if there was any chance that they wanted kids, I knew I wanted kids right away.
Okay.
But I still was kind of on the fence about having kids.
Yes.
Until I met my wife.
Yep.
And she was, you know, this model of what I thought was, you know, perfection in motherhood, right? She was an engineer, had recently left the military, but had left engineering to become an early childhood educator. So she was brains, right, in having completed Royal Military College and a mechanical engineering degree as a female who has dyslexia,
right,
right, in a male-dominated industry and society.
Yep.
But then had left that in order to work with children.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just an incredibly powerful story.
Yes.
And she, on top of that, she was working with kids with autism, right? So an incredible amount of patience and compassion and all yes. of that. And that made me really want to have kids.
Mm-hmm.
It reinforced why I wanted to have kids yeah. and who I wanted to have kids with.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of put the nail in the coffin there. You know, I'm not really trying to use that as a metaphor for it, but in somewhat of a way that it's true. And so, you know, within 2 years of us meeting, we had a child.
Yep.
Right. We had our first daughter. So we were, you know, met living together within 2 months, engaged 6 months after that, married 4 months after that, kid 1 year later.
Yep. How has fatherhood changed you?
It's a good question.
Thank you.
I would say it has probably made me more patient than I ever was before. It's made me more compassionate than I ever was before. Now when I watch within a commercial limits. Within limits for sure. But now when I watch a commercial, like a sappy commercial, like I'll get a little tear in my eye where I right. never would have before.
Yes.
Right. Anything to do with kids or parenting or that sort of stuff gets me a little like emotional now, yeah. whereas it wouldn't have before. And so it's had a big impact on me. At the same time, when I first had kids, it made me incredibly focused on being able to provide for the family.
Okay.
Right. I immediately wanted to grow my own vegetables. I got really interested in things like permaculture and homesteading and hunting and I'd always been a fisherman, but it really drove that passion for all of that for me and okay. wanting to be able to make my own stuff and yep. I wanted to, no matter what, be able to take care of my family.
Yes.
So yeah, it's had a pretty big impact on me, both, you know, positive and I, in some aspects, probably negative as well. I there are moments where I'm significantly less patient and I feel I beat up on myself when I make mistakes as a parent.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas I didn't usually do that before. I was fairly self-confident and now I certainly notice the areas where I have weakness in my life.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm less, probably less self-confident than I was before because of it.
It feels like parenting is, I think maybe the reason why it's so hard on ourselves a little bit more is because you know that before, you know, you make a mistake or something, it's sort of on you. Mm-hmm. You're not really affecting, if you're doing something or other, you're affecting perhaps someone else, but it's not necessarily someone else that you truly know, or, you know, you run a stop sign accidentally mm-hmm. and you're like, oh man, that's sorry. But then you're able to pass it because, well, I don't know that guy.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas in this world, I feel.
Yeah.
Where it is.
You have, when you make a mistake as a parent, it feels like you have this compounding, almost like exponential impact, not only on your kids, but on your kids' kids and your kids' kids' kids. And like, it's like a butterfly this effect through generations. Right.
Yeah.
So yeah, you are more significantly more concerned about your mistakes.
Yeah.
No matter what area of your life you're talking about, but you know, your profession certainly is a big one. I feel that weight all the time, right? Because I'm a business owner.
Yeah.
And so I feel like if I'm not successful in this, like how am I going to put food on the table for my family?
Right.
You know, I know I've got a huge community and support network that would never allow my family to go unfed. But at the same time, I feel responsible for that and responsible for how that's going to impact my kids.
So looking back in time again, just from some similarities between your parents and what they have done in terms of their work ethic and mm-hmm. Not only work ethic, but just more so time involvement and the part of the reasons why sort of going to the boarding school, et cetera, was mm-hmm. because they were working so much, et cetera. As a business owner, and business owners often don't take breaks, mm-hmm. etc. Do you see any similarities at all between those and or what are your thoughts regarding that?
Yes.
I won't lead you into
anything. Yeah, no, I definitely for 10 years saw a lot of similarities where I had a profession where I was on the road constantly. And so I would spend 120 nights a year in hotel rooms somewhere mm-hmm. else other than at home.
Yeah.
And that had a really detrimental effect on my family. But it was my work ethic to be, you know, good in my career and successful and to provide for my family, that sort of thing. But it got to a point where it was you know, it was having an impact on my relationship with my wife, and the kids would get upset because I would come home for a day and then I'd be gone again for a couple days, and it was really hard on them. And so, yeah, I did the same thing that my parents did, but I made a decision 2 years ago now, 2 years ago this month, to change that and to move away from the traveling lifestyle to be at home more.
Yeah.
And I mean, thank goodness this year, because I was able to be at home the entire time. I mean, I don't think I would have been traveling much anyways with the other job, but I was home and actually had that year to get into the groove of being home with my kids. If it had just been, okay, yeah, travel, dead stop at right. home, yeah. I think that would have been a huge shock to our household. Right. And I think that would have really made things challenging. Because when I was away, when I was traveling so much, you know, Rachel had a certain methodology for running the household. And I was kind of this, you know, thing that swept in and swept out. And she would say to me constantly when I'd come back, she's like, you understand, Warren, it takes like 3 days for us to get used to you being here again. And if you leave within those first 3 days, you know, it throws everything off. Because we run the household a specific way when you're not here. Then you come back in and want change on everything to the way that you would do it.
Right.
And then you leave again. And she was always left cleaning up the mess that I made.
Right.
And so I think that if I'd still been doing the traveling and then we'd hit COVID, it would have just destroyed us.
Mm-hmm.
Because I wouldn't have had any time to adjust to being home with the family.
So speak to the adjustments. What have you noticed that were some positive things and maybe some negative things as well about mm-hmm. being around some more and everything else involved?
Yeah. You know, in terms of some of the positives, I've certainly developed a better relationship with the girls.
Mm-hmm.
In doing bedtimes and being around a lot more, giving them the opportunity to come to me for whatever it is they may need. They didn't do that for the longest time because they weren't accustomed to me being home.
Right.
So if they needed something, it was mommy, mommy, mommy. Right. Now we're 2 years in.
Right.
And they're still getting accustomed to coming to me to ask for things. Yes. So that's a positive thing in terms of Rachel's sanity, because it's not always mommy, mommy, mommy now. It's yes. only 90% mommy, mommy, mommy. You know, some of the other good things, we've talked about this in a previous episode with regards to the differences in parenting style for Rachel and I. So I bring a lot more structure and authoritative parenting style to the table. And so that's helping us to get a few things on track, like in terms of recently sleeping has been a big thing for us. Like our 6-year-old daughter, up until a month ago, had never really slept through the night, right? Maybe one or two occasional nights here or there, but she just didn't sleep. Every night she would come up and right. get Rachel or crawl into our bed.
Right.
And it's only in the last month where we've kind of made some significant changes to the way that we put them to bed and how, you know, they don't co-sleep anymore, those sorts of things. Through some of that, okay, this has to change mentality that we've been able to get her. And she's now in the last 10 days has slept through the night 6 days in a row. Right. And that's a huge change, not just from a her health perspective, but also from my wife's health perspective.
Yes. It's somewhat of a tangent, I know, but I'm curious. We did another podcast yeah. about the lost hour of sleep.
Yeah.
Have you noticed any changes at all? I mean, it's maybe a little too early to tell.
I think it's a little too early to tell. I had definitely noticed that, so this is for Lilia, the 6-year-old, she was becoming more and more emotional every day, probably because she was not getting the amount of sleep that she required.
Mm-hmm.
She's still very emotional right now, but, you know, almost big swings in emotions where she's very cuddly and lovey, and then, you know, something doesn't go her way and she's melting down.
Okay.
And crying and throwing a fit, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine a lot of that has to do with a lack of sleep and that loss of sleep over such a prolonged period.
Yes.
That it has done some damage. And we're hoping that by getting her back on track in terms of, you know, 7:30 every night, she starts her bedtime routine and the alarm doesn't go off until 7 o'clock in the morning to get her up. So she's, you know, hopefully getting 11 hours of consistent sleep every night.
Yes.
Through the night.
Yep.
We're really hoping that's going to help to make up for some of that.
I'd be very interested in just even talking to the teacher after a little bit and just,
yeah,
even maybe throwing them out now. It'd be very interesting to know,
yeah,
whether they've noticed anything.
Yeah, it will be interesting. I mean, the teacher she's got now, she's only had for 2 months. So I'm not sure if she'll be able to give the greatest background picture, but I mean, we'll have to see. We'll see if she's able to notice Lilia's attentiveness in the classroom or those sorts of things.
Yeah.
So, there's a number of things that I would say have been both positive and negative with regards to me being around more. I would say the biggest positive, though, is the opportunity for the relationship to develop between me and the girls.
Yeah.
And, you know, because
I'm... negative?
The negatives, I mean, it's put a lot of pressure on the relationship between Rachel and I, because it was easy to not deal with relationship issues when you know your partner isn't going to be there in a couple days.
Right.
Right? You never really had to put out the fire because you could just walk away from it.
Right.
Right. I knew that I would be leaving for travel shortly and I could go and just forget about it. She knew that I was leaving and so didn't have to worry about it.
Yes.
Now, because we're constantly around each other, we have to deal with those issues.
Right.
Right? Which caused a huge amount of tension. I mean, we're working through all that and getting help to work through all that, because trying to do it yourself, I think, is pretty much impossible when you've got two pig-headed, stubborn individuals, right? So,
and partially, maybe I'm just hypothesizing that if, like anything of a routine or habits or whatever, if the method of dealing with the situation was going someplace else and sort of just forgetting about it, you know, that's something that gets built in over a period of time, and it's harder to shift back to another way, that listing ship that I was talking about.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly hard to do it in a COVID time.
Yes.
Like there is literally nowhere to escape to. So, yeah, it put a lot of pressure on our relationship.
Yeah.
Add into that the other issues that we've had with the kids this year. And it's really put pressure on the relationship. Mm-hmm. It was like throwing us into a pressure cooker.
Yeah.
But, you know, you could also see that as a positive in that we're both putting in the effort to get through those challenges rather than running away from them.
Yep. That's all we can do.
Mm, that's exactly right.
So you asked a good question of me, the last for my interview. And just the three individuals that you'd like to interview over your lifetime. And I'm interested to hear what you would say.
I mean, it's a good question. And I was thinking about it while you were answering it as well. And I really liked your answers. I think the first person, you know, somebody I'd really like to interview would be like Barack Obama. I think he's got an incredible story, both as a parent, but also as an individual has overcome a lot of societal biases, who has risen to what could easily be considered the peak of power without becoming or moving towards the what I assume would be a natural desire to become a dictator, right? Which we've seen recently, you know, and has really done that in a manner that you can look up to,
Right.
Right. Whether you agree or disagree with his politics, he did it in a way that was statesmanlike. You know, he kept his chin up the entire time, and there's something really inspiring about the guy, not just in what he's accomplished, but what his wife has accomplished,
mm-hmm.
and how he has dealt with his kids and everything.
Yes.
He's a very impressive individual.
Right.
In terms of the second person, I would have loved to have interviewed Anthony Bourdain. I mean, we're talking about somebody who's deceased now, but I think his view on the world was incredibly unique.
Okay.
And I think that for somebody who had gone through so many struggles, including addiction and mental health issues and all of that, he was able to bring light to topics that other people ignored in a way that was consumable. Right. And he did a few of my favorite things, you know, eating and having drinks and traveling. Like he lived a lifestyle that was one to be looked up to.
Yes.
And he had two different personas. You know, he had a public persona where he was out, you know, having drinks and enjoying himself. But then he also had his private persona where he spoke about that he never drank at home, right? It was only as a part of his profession and his career that he ever did that. And I think that would have been really interesting to explore.
Yes.
I still get sad every year when the anniversary of his death passes. Mm. Like, of all the celebrity deaths, that's one that actually had an impact on me.
Wow, okay.
So, I think that he would have been a very interesting person to interview. In terms of who else would I love to interview? Oh, it's a tough one. I know I had a third one the other night when we were doing your interview. Who would it be? I think, you know what? I would love to interview my dad. And I think I probably will. I've been thinking about this for a couple weeks, is I'd like to sit down and get my dad's stories.
Yeah.
And my dad has always been my idol, right? Granted, my dad's not flawless, right? He has some flaws. But he's an incredibly interesting person. And I don't know if I've met anybody who is so highly regarded and respected by everyone that I know.
Okay.
I've only ever had one person that I have experienced who has spoken badly of my father.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only because my dad happened to have fired the guy.
Right.
Because he was stealing from his clients.
Minor detail. Right?
Minor detail. And so, I would really like to sit down and, you know, after talking to Ryan from Complicated Fatherhood.
Yes.
You know, and how he did that interview with his dad. I would love to do that with my dad and get his stories of growing up. Because, you know, my dad was born in India, came over to North America on a boat, you know, grew up without his dad, so really had no father figure because mm-hmm. his dad was working in India for a long time and then, you know, around BC. And yet played such a pivotal role in my growing up.
Right.
And he's got a personality that is such where he questions everything, but he will always give me a support.
Yeah.
Right? He makes me question every decision I'm about to make, right? But no matter which direction I go with that decision, he's there 100%.
Yeah.
And so I think it would be a really interesting interview. And anybody who didn't know my dad would just be absolutely enthralled with him by the time it was done.
Right.
So those would be my three.
Yeah. And last question that I could... If if you could step into my shoes,
mm-hmm.
What would you have asked yourself that I haven't asked?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I would say, maybe I have two. I would say, what are the three, or what is the biggest lesson that you would like to leave your kids with? And then the other question would be, what are a few of the colloquial phrases that you live your life by?
Well, good questions, Warren.
Okay, so biggest lesson that I would love to impart on my girls is that passion and inspiration are the most important aspects of your life, and that everything else will follow that.
Mm-hmm.
That if you can find something you're passionate about and that inspires you, whether that's within your personal relationships, you know, like I've got you as somebody who inspires me to be a better dad all the time, right? Whether it's in your profession, whether it's in your romantic relationships, finding people that make you feel passionate and inspired, and professions that make you feel passionate and inspired, is the most important thing.
Yep.
And will guide you better than anything else possibly will.
Right.
In terms of colloquial phrases, I mean, these are a couple that my dad has passed down to me, right? And have meant the world to me, and I think about them all the time.
Yeah.
Probably the biggest one that my dad repeats constantly is never burn your bridges. No matter how pissed off you are at somebody, right? Leave that relationship with a bridge intact, because you never know when somebody's going to be your boss, right? Or client, or...
Yeah.
Whatever role they may play in your life in the future.
Right.
And so treat everybody with respect, even if the relationship is ending on a sour note.
Yeah.
The other thing is that life is a perpetual struggle to find balance. Much like, you know, what you were talking about earlier and in the boat listing, that sort of thing. Every aspect of your life is a constant struggle to find some semblance of balance.
Yeah.
Whether it's going too far into too much time with your family, too much time at work, whatever it may be, there's a balance to everything, and every aspect of your life is trying to pull you out of balance. And our job as parents, people, you know, citizens, is to always find that balance.
Right.
Right. Is to work your way back into it. Whether that's socioeconomic divide, whether it's political disparity, anything we're talking about. Right, finding balance is the key struggle.
Yeah.
So I would say those are probably a couple of the colloquial phrases that I live my life by.
Yeah.
And you know, and those would be the lessons that I hope that I can impart on my girls.
Well, thanks very much, Warren. I appreciate you taking the time to allow me to interview you.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And you know, folks that are listening, this comes to the end of this here. Ultimately, what we'd always like to ask is, you know, if you do enjoy this podcast, this particular show, etc., go out there. It really would help us a lot if you're able to rate us, hopefully high, of course, ideally. And those ratings, the comments, etc., it really helps us get out to other individuals. Feel free to share this pod to anyone else out there. That would be wonderful. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
See you later.